Anyway, hello everybody, great to be here, all the formalities. I've called this Art Criticism in the Age of Publicity because we've reached a very peculiar time writing art criticism where a lot of people are not really actually even sure what it is anymore. Yeah. I've been writing for like a very long time. It's actually the only thing I've ever done as a profession apart from a year and a bit as head of Australian art at the National Gallery. That's really the only 9-to-5 job I've ever had in my life. So to be able to continuously write has been a bit of a privilege, partly because not many people can make a living out of continuously writing art criticism or anything else. But it's also because it's been a fantastic sort of ongoing journey. It's been an ability for me to be what I can only think of as a chance to be a lifelong student. When I finished at Sydney University with a degree in English literature and philosophy, I thought, well, all I'm ever going to do is just hang around the university and keep doing more of this. But after I tasted a little bit of writing for publication, I thought, no, I don't want to do the university stuff anymore. I'm out there into the wide world, and that's where I've been ever since. In Ray Monk's biography of Wittgenstein, we read how Wittgenstein urged Carl Britton, as he urged most of his students, to avoid becoming a professional philosopher. He said, there's only one thing worse, and that was being a journalist. You can see that even to Wittgenstein, being a journalist meant being a trivializer of life, a voyeur of current affairs and society, looking for an angle to make things palatable to a general public. Now, it's grossly unfair to the best journalists, but it's only too true about the bulk of what passes as newspaper content today. When I go and buy, every weekend I go to the garage and I buy the Herald, the Australian, and the Financial Review, and invariably the man behind the counter says to me, "What? No telly?" And I say, "No, no telly." And he says, "Why not?" And I say, "Because it's trash." It's our regular little ritual exchange we have. And what does a critic do? A critic decides that something is trash. It's the critic can say what's good, what's bad. You don't have to be right, because what you have is basically an opinion. But your opinion can't just be, "Oh, I loved it, I gave it 4 stars." It has to be something that's actually backed up by a little bit of an argument. I didn't have time to discuss why the telly is trash, but anyway. Can critics be classed as journalists? Yes and no. But there's a confusion even among so-called critics today as to whether critics are journalists or not. Where do you draw the line between giving information and action and making value judgments? Are critics there to be supportive of the arts, supportive of various artists, supportive of galleries and arts entrepreneurs, or are you there to be a kind of umpire, to look hard at what they're doing, to say whether something works or doesn't work? I tend a little bit towards the latter side of the equation. Even though if you look at the bulk of what one writes over the course of many, many years, I dare say 90% of it is broadly favourable. The pieces that people always remember are the negative pieces. If you write a rather damning piece about something or other, that is the one they'll still be talking to you about years into the future. Or indeed, if you can satirise something. I found every time I've tried to go into a little bit of satire or parody, those pieces are immensely quoted. I hear them over and over and over. So the worst thing in the world is having to be a comic writer. If you have to be professionally funny, this is why so many comedians actually go home and commit suicide or something like that. It's the most depressing business on earth because everybody's waiting for you to be funny, and then when they say, "That wasn't very funny," or "That's not so funny, what's funny about that?" So eventually it's just like one long recipe for failure. When you're writing criticism, I think you have to be serious fundamentally most of the time, and then you can allow yourself a little bit of leeway to venture into comedy. It's more fun if it comes unexpectedly. Now, it used to be that critics had a kind of a role and a status. People, we should have these crazy ideas about critics that we see in popular film, like in All About Eve, where George Sanders plays the critic Addison DeWitt. My name is Addison DeWitt, and he's a star maker and a star breaker. You know, he promotes the young Anne Baxter, and he quietly dampens down the aging Betty Davis. But we know who's calling the shots. It's Addison DeWitt, and he's the king of the theatre. He's much feted by all. Well, this is a total fantasy nowadays. I don't think critics are feted by anybody very much. And if they are feted, they're feted not because they're star makers and star breakers. They're feted because they are conveyors of useful information. I've known dealers and I've known gallery people who are quite happy to have anything written about them. Even if you write something saying it's all rubbish, they're happy for that. That's fine, because they know. And I think everybody should understand that there's a whole lot of people out there who will read what you write every week just for the pleasure of disagreeing. They say, oh, he thinks that's a good show, I'm sure it's terrible. Or, oh, he really loved that, I know it's going to be bad. Or vice versa, it happens all the time. This is the joy of writing criticism. The other fun of it is, of course, that I always try not to be entirely predictable. So what you say one week is not entirely what you're going to say the next. You don't hammer away like a broken record at the same things. Even if you're reviewing somebody that you might have reviewed three or four times before, you find another angle, you find another way in. When, a few years ago, James Elkins wrote a little book called Whatever Happened to Art Criticism, he sent out a questionnaire to, I think, 60 art critics in America. Where he could find 60 art critics in America, I don't know. But he sent it out, and he asked them what they thought was the most and least important thing about writing art criticism. And this was towards a definition of art criticism today. The responses were quite staggering, because the vast overwhelming majority of people said that the most important thing that an art critic does is to give information about a show. The least important thing that a critic does is to have an opinion about a show. Now, I would think that if you don't have an opinion about a show, you couldn't really call yourself a critic anyway. I think what you're writing is information, publicity. And the gradual shading of criticism into publicity, so that the line is getting blurred, is, I think, a real issue. If you look at the influence of social media, where people are just knocking off tweets and Instagrams and very quick lines about things, this isn't criticism, this is just a response. And of course, on blogs and websites, the same thing is repeated over and over and over. To keep the content up on a web page, people just simply cut and paste, stick something down, get a press release, stick it on. And so, if you look up a particular exhibition, you'll find the same stuff repeated over and over and over from people all over the world who've simply done nothing but cut and paste. As you know, at universities, a whole lot of students believe that cutting and pasting actually equals writing an essay. But the ability to do Apple X and Apple V is not really what we're looking for in a critic. With the critics, in so many cases today, well, it's always been a certain degree that critics have been hired guns. It's the idea of the guru critic, the Clement Greenberg, the Harold Rosenberg, the ones which exert a massive influence on the era, which tell us who the great artists of our time are, where the movements of history are going. I don't think those critics really exist anymore. For a long time, the big American critics have been pretty much hired guns. They've been people who worked for magazines like Art in America, Art Forum or something like that, who would basically write the approved official essay about an artist which was in line with a big exhibition at a particular gallery which took out an advertisement in the magazine. Everybody knows that's how it's worked, everybody goes along with it, and it still happens today. Now, there was leeway in that for a little bit of disagreement or for saying something a bit original or a bit different, but it's fundamentally putting criticism at the service of commerce. When Robert Hughes wrote his famous essay Art and Money in 1984. It was a ferocious jeremiad against the encroachments of the art market on what he understood to be art criticism, art history, and the general public appreciation of the diversity and the difference of art, the idea that art was something that, you know, we could come and make an individual assessment of, rather than be told that such and such an artist is an indisputable genius and nothing much can be done. Well, it was a devastating essay in its day. It was powerful, it was much reproduced, much talked about, but now it's something that seems almost irrelevant. It seems like almost laughable in its premises, because the market, the art the uber galleries and the uber curators and institutions that work so closely with them have become the massive power block, the prime movers in the art world. Critics play a very secondary role. If I were to go out there and write constantly that Damien Hirst or Jeff Koons were not very good artists, well, what difference would that make to their careers? Very, very little, if any. In fact, it might even get more people looking at them. That's what usually happens. That's what I tell artists if they're being a bit critical of, that, you know, it means that more people are looking at your work. Or occasionally you meet artists who you've given a slightly negative review to, like I did this with Richard Goodwin once, and of course you always run into them the very next day. And Richard said, "You didn't like my show, John." And I said, "I wasn't too harsh, was I, Richard?" He said, "No," he said, "I had a review once that said that my work was equal to the worst excesses of Mussolini. And after that, I've never really been able to see anything as a bad review." Well, there was another artist, I think it was Gary Shedd, who, again, I'd been critical of, and I ran into him almost instantly. He said, "You didn't like my show." I said, try not to be too nasty about that. He said, "Oh, that's all right, it wasn't a very good show." But for everyone like that, there are others who are permanently sort of steaming that I could dare to contradict their works of genius. Anyway, the idea that critics, so-called critics, could say that the most important thing for them is to give information to me is a complete and utter subjugation of oneself to the marketplace, a complete and utter subjugation to the logic of information. Because what we have now is nobody really has to learn very much or think about very much when all the information you need is at your fingertips. Criticism should be set free to be more discursive, to be more engaged, to be more wide-ranging, and to bring in a whole, you know, stack of things that you might not have thought of before. Critics are there to make you think in a different way. Critics are there to make you think twice about the stuff that's in front of you. Critics are there to query the logic of the press release. In fact, what happens is that with the shrinking size of newspapers, with diminishing budgets, and with the attention spans being atrophied by social media, there is more and more pressure on newspapers just to cover things in a very piecemeal way without really going into too much depth. I've found over the years that in the early 80s I wrote an art column for the Sydney Morning Herald. It was more than 3,000 words a week. It was like writing a term paper every single week. But it was an incredible exercise, and I felt like at that length I could really do something. And that was because we had a very sympathetic editor in John Alexander. Then I went away to England. I came back to Australia. Actually, no, the other way around. I'd already come back from England, but I went off to the National Gallery and was in Canberra for a while. But when I came back to the paper years later, because they asked me to come back, I had 1,500 words, so I had basically half the space. Within a few years, that had gone down to 1,200 words, and now they've diminished it again to 1,000 words. Now, I don't really think that I could do it much smaller than that, because when you're used to thinking in a certain size and used to thinking with a certain degree of discursivity, to suddenly rein it all in means that something's got to give, something's got to go in that column, whether it be your, you know, your thoughtful philosophical introduction, whether it be your long detailed explanation of a particular work, you know, all sorts of things that could be there are no longer there, and you feel like the writing is impoverished with it. But there's a genuine belief that people just can't read that much. So they think 1,000 words is about the limit. Of course, when you look at the page is two-thirds advertisements and one-third writing stuck in a little box. So I always tell people, rather than look at the stuff in the newspaper, go to my website because you can read the unexpurgated versions. I've worked with some very good editors over the years, ones who would ring me at 9 o'clock in the evening and say, John, I've been thinking about the column this week, and in the third paragraph from the end, I think we should take out the word the. And I pause to make it seem credible and say, okay, I can live with that. But now, of course, they'll cut out whole sentences and they'll rearrange things, and they're not doing it because they hate you. They're doing it because they haven't got time, because there are too few people trying to put together too many pages under too much pressure. And so I've got to the stage where instead of being cranky about cuts and changes, and I simply say, just look at the stuff on the website, because that's where the proper article appears rather than the Reader's Digest version. In these days also, as newspapers come under more and more pressure, there's a kind of thinking amongst a lot of editors that, well, the arts are a soft touch. It's not like politics or business or sport, you know, it's not serious. It's the sort of thing that you can cut. And a lot of newspapers have simply reduced arts coverage to things like recycled press releases. Indeed, I've heard publicists conversing with each other, talking about how many of their press releases have been reprinted in newspapers as articles. And I mean, I've even seen this. I've seen things in The Age which were just basically press releases but with somebody else's name over the top of them, because I had the same press release in front of me and then I'd be reading an article with, you know, three paragraphs reappearing. Anyway, I have a particular dislike of stuff like that. But the other thing that goes on is that newspapers are really thinking all the time about their audience, about where the trends are, about what they're interested in, and so everything is lifestyle, is entertainment rather than the arts. They're terrified, even the so-called broadsheet papers, that they might be writing something which is too highbrow, which is too elitist, which goes over the heads of their audience. And I've always thoroughly believed that you should never patronise your audience. If somebody has made the commitment to read an art column anyway, they've obviously got a standing interest. They just haven't come in cold. And if they have come in cold, what you've written should be good enough to make them read it to the end. You should have something which runs like a thread of argument through the piece, and then they can read it, hopefully, for the pleasure of the article, for the pleasure of the writing, let alone whether they know something about it or not. But on the other hand, it's a niche market, and I've always understood it's a niche market. You have to be able to do something which addresses a literate, yeah, you have to assume there's a certain amount of literacy in that audience, and there are a bunch of people who read the Herald, say not the Woman's Weekly this week or something, and that they are prepared to follow you if you have a difficult concept, if you have a slightly complex idea, but if it's explained in simple language, if it's talked about in a straightforward manner. And a lot of art writing, we know, is exactly the opposite of that. I've always believed that good writing and good writing about art conveys the maximum amount of information and ideas in the most economical means. But in fact, what goes on with a lot of academic writing on art in journals seems to be precisely the opposite, that you use the maximum number of words to say as little as possible. There's also a certain pressure that comes from institutions who find that they don't really want to be criticised in the newspaper. Because they're potential advertisers, this puts pressure on editors as well. They don't really want their critics to be out there putting the boot into the National Gallery or the Art Gallery of New South Wales or Art Gallery of South Australia, when those are potentially people who are going to take full-page advertisements in the newspaper, and they don't like it very much. And I think the good papers are the ones that can draw the line and say, hey, what we do with advertising and what we do with commentary are two totally different things. Now, the newspaper I work for, the Sydney Morning Herald, is of course just about to be swallowed up by Channel 9. So we'll see what that happens. I mean, there have been dire portents, and as usual, the management says, it's going to be fantastic, it's going to ensure editorial independence, and it's all going to be great. But if I'm replaced by Tracy Grimshaw or Richard Wilkins, you'll know what happened. And I think, just briefly, before we have some questions, the whole thing about criticism is you shouldn't think of criticism as just a simple thing. Criticism, for me, is a literary form. When it's well done, it's a kind of literature. It's not, you don't walk around saying, oh, I'm doing some marvellous creative writing. You're not writing fiction, you're not writing War and Peace or remembrance of things past. You're writing something that responds to a particular exhibition, a particular artist, a particular body of work. You're writing a responsive form, not an out-and-out creative form. But to me, within that those boundaries, you've got tremendous room to move, and you can basically do something pretty interesting if you put your mind to it. As a critic, you've got to be an enemy of banality. So much of what one reads about the arts is just plain dull. It's descriptive, it's dull, it tells you nothing much, it doesn't get you thinking. If you don't leave a reader of what you've written with a few thoughts, even if they're thoughts that are irritations, then you're never going to actually make any impact at all writing art criticism. King's the Amos said, there's really no point in writing something if you can't offend anyone. Well, he offended lots of people, but there's something to it. When there's something to it, when you find that, the Australia Council commissioned that Saatchi report that time that spent $350,000 and came up with the insight that while some Australians love the arts, others do not feel so positive about them. And people who feel positive about the arts engage with them for a variety of reasons. Now, this is where this is where the arts are in terms of government policy. This is where the arts are talked about on the highest levels. So I think critics have to, in many ways, to get down and dirty and to do things on a lower level, but a grassroots level, and address an audience in the voice that the audience understands. I'll finish there. I could go on and on, but I'll finish.